Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhelman. Today, I'm welcomed by my co-host and good friend, Jennifer Hashley. Hey, Jennifer, how you doing?
I'm great, Aaron. Thank you so much.
Hey, it is always a pleasure. And I welcome the opportunity to continue our conversations. We've been doing this now a couple times a week. What an opportunity it is for Sourcing Matters.
It's great discussion.
It is. So, Jennifer, I'm going to give a quick background for you. We'll jump into the conversation thereafter, all right? So you're the director of the New Entry Sustainable Farming Project, which is a revolutionary program that looks at sustainable and regenerative farming as jobs creation and economic growth for regions often in need of stimulus. Jen is also an agricultural science and policy lab instructor at Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition, Science and Policy, Agriculture, Food, and Environmental Program. And in partnership with her husband, she oversees the diversified pasture-based livestock operation, including Pete and Jen's backyard birds on Codman Community Farm in Lincoln, Massachusetts.
Yes, sir.
I did that one breath. That was pretty good.
That was pretty, really. That was amazing.
Hey, thanks. Thank you. So let's talk about food festivals, in fact, Jennifer, to start the conversation. We had the opportunity this weekend to partake in Let's Talk About Food at Harvard University, which was fun.
It was great.
Interesting conversations. We were on a panel focused on systems thinking around food production with Rid Shin. A lot of fun. And just generally, it brought out, I think, all different types of individuals within food, within consumption, with the whole spectrum. People trying to become more aware of really what food represents, right?
Absolutely. Yep. And the chefs were involved and public was there and vendors, food artisans, and others, I think, trying to share the good word about quality of food and how food can connect people.
It was, yeah, and it was an orchestrated crew, right? I mean, it was people, whether you're a chef or folks like us, which are a little more upstream, or producers like yourself, you know, it seemed everyone was there around elevated standards in production. People cared about where food was coming from. On the flip side of that, I also went to the Tops Field Fair. You remember that?
Oh, yes. That's a scene.
That's a good way to describe it. It was a scene. The oldest active fair, I think, in the United States, or currently or concurrent active. I'm not sure what the sign says, but it's something along those lines. The oldest, one of the oldest in the States. Yeah, it was interesting. The food was awful. Everything's fried. No discussion about sourcing. It was, as Rodney Dangerfield would say in Caddyshack, tell the chef this is low-grade dog food, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, not good stuff. But my family, we watch this show on the Food Network on occasion, almost like, you know, the half hour of fluff. It's called Carnival Eats.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. It's crazy. Just watching it for the...
extreme food factor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, who can fry what and splice it together? And they have this host named Noah Cape or Cap. I don't know if it goes with the French pronunciation or English here, but he gets right up in people's face with the microphone and watches them eat these like interesting contraptions of food. Look at that. And we joke like, that's how I sometimes host my podcast. So it's terrible to think I'm looking at this eating terrible food. It's like the what I try to stay away from, but I find myself kind of as I'm at the Topsfield Fair eating fried Twinkies. I didn't eat it, but, you know, looking at this, thinking, oh, my goodness.
The crazy things are the gigantic turkey drumsticks. Have you seen those? Like people walking around looking like cavemen with these gigantic, enormous turkey legs.
It's an empowering thing, I think, for some, right? Yeah. Bring it back to it.
Live your fantasy.
Well, food festivals are interesting, and all festivals, I guess, that incorporate with food. And fall brings out a lot of those. But, you know, I think there's hope aside from the Topsfield Fair, and we had conversations like we talked about with Let's Talk About Food. But there are some real quality festivals, there's some really quality programs out there that celebrate more of who we are, what we can do, and some of them are steeped in history, and some of them were spawned by great concepts. And that actually brings us to our conversation today. Today we welcome a passionate mover and shaker and thinker with a focus in agriculture and food policy, with 10 years of experience working to better farmer livelihoods and foster more sustainable food systems. and having a specialty that include advocacy, public policy, coalition building, and communication and storytelling. Today we welcome Alicia Harvey, who's the head of advocacy and issues director at FarmAid. Hey, Alicia, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm all right. Have you ever been to the Topsfield Fair?
I haven't been to the Topsfield Fair. I grew up, I was born in Exeter, New Hampshire, and we used to go to the Stratford Fair all the time up there. So I have fond memories.
Fond memories, right? And when you're a kid, you remember it differently than you do now, right? Mm-hmm. You go in there and you see different things, mm-hmm. right? You when you're an adult and you go to those types of fairs and you see, boy, I don't think that ride looks safe. Whereas a kid,
yeah. And you wait all year to eat that fried elephant ear or the fried dough.
And you think horrifically at your parents. What were you doing? Why were you bringing me into this? Just kidding.
That's right.
Now I go and talk to the dairy folk and learn about their cows, which I did not do when I was a kid.
That's right.
So. Exactly. There are some educational components. Mm-hmm. You know, they do the showing of the animals and the spinning and weaving and, you know, knitting and other craft features that I think we've lost. So there's value to mm-hmm. keeping that alive.
That's right.
Absolutely.
There was a piglet swimming competition. How's that? That's
happened. Oh, I'm sorry I missed that.
Yeah, there you go.
That's adorable.
So, Lisa, let's talk a little bit about your work at FarmAid. So I read that you guide the organization's advocacy, research, farmer services, and policy-related activities. You come from with a background in agricultural and environmental science and policy from the Tufts Friedman School of Nutrition and Policy, and you have previous work where you worked with U.S. farm household economics. So you spent interviewing farmers across several states. And that was part of your undergrad thesis mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. Alicia is also a music junkie and that you spend quite a bit of time, I think, teaching yoga, hiking, cooking, and traveling. So a lot of things that immerse you into your environments.
Yeah.
Cool. So you recently had a big event, a big festival down in near Hartford, Connecticut, mm-hmm. and it was FarmAid 2018. Mm-hmm. How was the event?
It was amazing. It was amazing. We had 24,000 festival goers join us at Xfinity Theater in Hartford. And, you know, as it's become, it's really a full day affair. We open the doors for a press event that features our four board artists. So Willie Nelson, our founder, John Mellencamp, Neil Young, Dave Matthews, to rally everyone for a day of celebrating farmers and good food from family farmers. We spent a lot of time in the lead up to the show scouring out stories that need to be told about the region that's hosting us. So there were a number of farmers, youth programs in more urban areas in Connecticut that we were able to interview. And we have those videos that we show during the press event, and then the artists and several of the farmers or food systems activists or youth or whoever it may be who are there engage in a conversation about what we're here, why are we celebrating, what's this all about, what's this moment we're in. And then the show starts, and it starts from noon until 11 p.m. or so. So it's a full day, and there's tons of stuff that goes on during the day. So we had a great time. We heard great things from folks who went. Yeah.
I would guess there's a lot of details. 24,000 people, that kind of top billing coming in. It's like running a huge tour from, I'm sure, like the biggest music tours out there, right? So you got that, but it's underpinned by a mission, practice, some real reason for doing this. So maybe you could share with the listening audience a little of the impetus of FarmAid and how it's progressed through the 30 years? How
33 years.
33
now.
Years.
Yeah. So we started in 1985 in the midst of the 1980s farm crisis. Willie Nelson, the story of the beginning is actually from Live Aid. So that was, you know, the mid-80s were this era of many, many artists coming together and celebrating a cause and trying to raise awareness and funds for it. And at Live Aid, Bob Dylan sort of mumbled something about some of this money should go to the farmers in the States. Headlines across the country were about farms going out of business and foreclosure. And increasingly about farmers dying by suicide, and this real sense of angst going on throughout rural America. And Willie himself you know, spent, he did, and he still to this day, spends so much of his time on the bus, driving through rural parts of the country. And so he saw that anguish too. And he, you know, heard what Bob Dylan said and said, yeah, we should do that. And so it kickstarted a several week process, working to have the first Farm Aid being held in Champaign, Illinois. There were 54 acts in best of music there to rally around farms and farmers and the people who grow our food. And so that mission of rallying, celebrating, and keeping family farmers on the land has remained through this day. I think in the early years, Willie and then his co-founders, John Mellencamp and Neil Young, thought, you know, they'd do this show, government would get itself together, and the problem would be fixed, and that was it. And then they would keep coming back year over year, and realizing that that wasn't how change was going to happen. And so since that time, you know, the annual festival that we do is obviously the highest sort of PR moment for the cause. I think a lot of folks like Jennifer and others who we know who are food systems activists, farmers themselves throughout the country, you know, recognize that it's a moment where it's one of the highest profile moments for those who are trying to change the food system. And we try to bring in elements of the year-round work into that day. And I think that what we've seen over the years is that that thread of why we need to have a mission around saving family farms is still relevant. Today, we would argue it's as important as ever. And there's been a broadening. You know, there's been people, we didn't have a good food movement to point to in the 80s. There wasn't another option for farmers who were large scale commodity farmers, undifferentiated markets. And now, you know, there's much more diversity in the kinds of markets folks can tap into. There's a lot more opportunities for folks to connect to their farmers. So there's, I would say, more challenges and more opportunities today. And the festival, the folks we celebrate and make sure their stories are being told on the day of the show, you know, it reflects that, that shift over time.
Jennifer, so you've been involved in a couple of farm aids. Did you go this year?
I actually got to participate in some of the pre-events that Alicia hasn't mentioned yet, but they also hosted a couple days of really amazing conversation, bringing together thought leaders and other very diverse actors in the food system, from practitioners and organized community organizers and farmers and fishermen and others, to have really engaging conversation. And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about how you organize those events leading up to the concert as well, which are also very appreciated by those who can participate.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the big parts of what I do around the show and the lead up to the show. And it also goes back to the roots of the organization, which was listening and hearing from farmers themselves and other folks about what the solutions were. And so there was a real ethic right from the beginning about grassroots engagement, grassroots organizing, and the need to meet people where they are. Through service work, there's development of hotlines and crisis centers and things like that that Farm Aid helped seed funding for or help that work get going. But then there was also, you know, community organizing and base building outfits throughout rural America. And the days leading up to the show are this opportunity for all those folks to come together from around the country. It's always an opportunity for us to introduce the country to the region that's hosting us that year and vice versa, to introduce the region to the Farm Aid family from across the country. And this year we really thought a lot about, you know, what's the story of agriculture in this region, New England, Connecticut, and what's the moment we're in? And we kept landing on this need to deal with the theme of resilience. There's a farm crisis rolling out in the country again. I think some would argue that we've never left the crisis that started in the 80s, that the same threats and forces that were instigating that remain today. And at the same time, you know, in New England, the face of that is often dairy. You know, we're in the middle of a real pricing crisis for dairy farmers. And there's also amazing work going on around change and bringing new people into the movement. But the moment we're in, the political moment, the stress in the countryside, anytime I would pick up the phone in the office and talk to somebody, one of our partners in a part of the country, there'd be this sense of exhaustion and this sense of putting out fires, thousands of fires at the same time. And so we said, you know, Farm Aid's a moment and has remained this place where we can bring people together in a community of love and have that organizing focus. And so we really wanted to have events that were grounded in that sense of love for each other and refill our cups, learn about how people do keep themselves going when times are tough. So we had amazing panels, folks who we had Native American and African American farmers from across the country and in the Concert region talk about the role of land and their connection and both what they're doing now, the cultural connection to land and the role that plays in resilience, the role it's played in power, good and bad for their communities. We had a panel talk about pivotal moments, and it was a set of organizers from across the country talk about what was the moment they realized their back was against the wall and they had to do something, and what motivated them to do that. And sort of amazing breakout sessions that dealt with aspects of resilience. So that was sort of our Thursday programming. We hosted a film screening that evening called Forgotten Farms, which is really about New England dairy farms in the region. We had a series of farm tours for folks. It's one of the highlights for people who come in from across the country to get a sense of food and farming in the Concert region and learn about it. We had our first ever fisheries tour that went to coastal Connecticut and Rhode Island and learned about fisheries and actually the immense commonalities between fishermen and family farmers and why their battle is the same one. And so a lot of folks who go to the concert don't know that kind of all of that is going on before the show. But those people end up being the face of the mission for folks. A lot of them on the day of the concert are actually hosting exhibits in what we call the Homegrown Village. This year we had 37 exhibits from organizations across the country and in the concert region who engaged festival goers in hands-on experiences. It could be, you know, getting your hands dirty in soil and learning about soil health. It could be games that, taught you about something in the food system. We had our homegrown skills tent where people learned how to save seeds and make cheese and hemp paper and all sorts of stuff. And so to me, it's really great that we can like have that community that we try to bring together in the lead up to the show also be there for concert goers and them get a sense of who we think the heroes are, both the farmers and the folks we work with who are working with farmers across the countryside. So I'm glad you brought it up.
Yeah, I feel like I spent most of Thursday crying in a good way. It was amazing. I think, yeah, just hearing people's stories and talking from the heart and kind of bringing it back to love, like you said, I feel like you could feel the palpable emotion in the room because you did bring people intentionally together to talk about resilience and strategy and just kind of be together and celebrate what we're all working toward. So it was really powerful, and I'm glad I was able to participate. I'm getting all teary-eyed just thinking about it right now.
I'm glad you were here, too. I was really, really glad you could make it. I thought your work is so important. And all that. I mean, I'm glad it felt that way because that was the intention, was that people would walk away with a new kind of inspiration, a new sense of connection, that none of us are in this alone. And there's a lot of really powerful leaders going on across the country. And there's a lot of commonality. It's so easy if you're only plugged into media, national news, to feel like we're in this really divisive moment. We obviously are. But, I could pick up the phone to someone in every state of this country. It's a great gift of working at Farm Aid that I can go to sleep at night knowing that there's people across the country who are fighting the good fight. And we're not as divided as we seem. And those people who are in the countryside doing that work, carrying that message of love, I think are going to be that bridge to a better future, because they know how to meet people where they are. And they know how to keep showing people, yeah, we know you're in pain, but let's get clear about why this is happening. Let's not scapegoat. Let's not take the easy answers. And let's realize that we've got to dig into a longer fight, but that there's a community around us doing it with us.
So do you feel that since it's 33 years in lineage here, you had mentioned some of the perils and the problems are the same, but maybe the support system is what's changed? Maybe we are becoming more aware of the human interest story, finding commonality. Maybe it is the farmer that's going to let us sit and cross the aisle someday and have political conversations that we'll find more that we're alike than different. What was your experience in seeing this, and how long have you been actually with Farm Aid, by the way?
Yeah, so I'm at about 9.5 years, I think. 9 years, 10 shows okay. on staff.
Okay,
yeah.
So in that 10 years, have you, it sounds like that's a lot of the work that you've been focused on, but maybe you could share with the audience some of, some pride points, some areas that you've really seen that elevation take place.
Yeah, you know, Jennifer and I know each other from Tufts. We both, she still works at the Agriculture, Food, and Environment program at the Nutrition School at Tufts. I was a student there, and I really exited that program as a wonk. You know, it's a policy and science program, I would always recommend it to anybody who's interested in sort of food's role in shaping our world and vice versa, because it, you know, it's extremely relevant. It remains relevant. The gift that I think Farm Aid gave me was it kept challenging me to get out of the wonk mode and understand that we need facts. Facts are on our side, it turns out, but people change through something more cultural, and people are motivated through something deeper and personal, and storytelling, the ability to meet people where they're at, and to hold space for multiple narratives and multiple ways of making change is really powerful. And I think that was something I discovered through Farm Aid, because its roots are obviously as a cultural organization with some of the strongest communicators in the world. As you know, on our board of directors, we're really lucky to have them be so committed to this over so much time. But also realizing that there's an incredible opportunity for somebody who's coming to the festival because they love Willie Nelson to start getting this taste of something deeper through the homegrown village, through what we do with concessions, where we completely change out the sourcing for the vending program at the venue location, and show that good food from family farmers is possible in any setting. You know, I could say something to my family for years about their choices with what they're buying at the grocery aisle or whatever the case may be, but it's not until they hear Neil Young on stage that they turn to me and say, oh, read the label. And like, I could have said that to them forever, right? But so I say that to underscore that, you know, it's an organization about people, about learning how to connect with people, about folks who, you know, in the 80s, and I was really lucky to, and continue to be lucky to, work with folks who maybe started or were in the midst of that struggle in the 80s, and it was a hard time in America, and a lot of them will tell you that today feels very similar. That in the midst of the pain going on in the countryside, there were really extremist voices trying to answer that pain with scapegoats, with divisive language, and that it was a struggle to keep bringing people back into a space of love and saying, look, we're trying, you know, there are forces who would rather us hate each other. And that ends up lining their pockets and ends up making it possible for them to keep dividing and conquering and taking out of rural communities for their own gain. We have to get clear on what we have in common and learn to build bridges. And so I think that's been this thread, the way of working, deep listening, realizing that there is power throughout the country, and that our job as Farm Aid is to hand the mic over to those farmers and those agitators and those system change makers, because their stories need to be told. And so the other thing we do, especially when you guys were talking about food festivals, it made me think one of the things that Farm Aid's always prioritized when we're offered a space to speak at a festival, let's say, or some kind of conference is, sometimes we will, but we'll often say, why don't we help pay for a farmer to get there and make sure their story is being told. And so often farmers aren't at the table in the discussions that they need to be. Hmm. Yeah.
So one of the questions that has come up for me, I feel like in doing this work for a long time, and I can't remember who said it, but I tried to quote it again last year at one of our conferences, that people are questioning, is there a good food movement? And I know that you've been at this for a long time, as Aaron's been saying, you know, how do we really accelerate that in this time of crisis? How, I mean, you're doing the good work of bringing people together and making sure that the voices are being heard, but how do we really glue that together more or faster or scale it?
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. I think that movements have to be addressing power. And, you know, one of the criticisms you'll hear when people talk about good food is that it's elitist in some way. And I think at its core, it's absolutely not. But if you are removing conversations about power from the work you're doing, then it has that risk, right? And I think that part of the work of this movement is to bridge commonality, you know, find those points of connection and understand how the power dynamics at play in food and agriculture are extremely relevant to other movements going on. You know, issues around immigration and farm worker rights are relevant to farmers. Issues around healthcare and affordability of healthcare are extremely relevant to farmers. It's why some of our most powerful organizing outfits in the Midwest are not only dealing with corporate power in agriculture and the influx of foreign-owned land in their home, they're dealing with Medicaid expansion and they're organizing around that. Issues around race have and continue to be extremely relevant to food and agriculture. The roots of our food system are in slavery, and a lot of those power dynamics persist today. And so what I think is some of the most powerful opportunities for folks who are interested in the food system is to keep making connections with other movements, understanding where there are commonalities, and also, if they're not already, understanding how those movements build power and how they're, you know, doing work, not just, you know, influencers and talking heads, right, but in the communities, knocking on doors, making things a voting issue, understanding how people enter that issue. Where is it in their psychic space, and how do they live and breathe it? Those are just a couple thoughts I have, but I really think it's a movement moment. People are saying that. And I think for those in food and agriculture, we've got to, whoever you are in it has to know who you are in it. You know, am I somebody with a certain amount of privilege and less skin in the game than somebody who's is, you know, there's class issues in farming. There are poor farmers. You know, are those poor farmers and farmers of color, are their stories being told? Are we holding space to make sure that their stories are being told? Yeah.
We focus a lot, obviously, on getting the word out, as Jennifer had mentioned, and, you know, how to translate many of these very complex discussions and make it applicable to much more. Seems like you have a very similar focus. And we talk about chefs being much of the rock stars of food, right? Getting the word out as these translators. You legitimately have rock stars come in to describe this. They don't have to be rock stars of food. So when you get Willie Nelson and Dave Matthews, Neil Young, you've got John, and when this started, John Cougar Mellencamp was right there. Now he's just John Mellencamp.
He's John Mellencamp.
Yep. Sturgill Simpson, living the dream.
Love
right?
Sturgill.
Another. Yep. Perfect. Great stuff. So you have a great way of triggering interest from both the farming community, but, you know, mainstream folks, the eaters of the world.
Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about that. It's not just the eaters, it's the workers of the future here.
And the statistic that is always thrown around is the average age of the American farmer is over 68. Yeah. And we joked this weekend that they've been saying that for a decade now, so maybe they're 78. Who knows, yeah. Right?
We'll know when the 2017 census hits the books.
Yeah,
soon.
That's
we'll
right.
We'll know soon.
We will know soon. Obviously a problem, a workforce issue here. Fred Kirschman told us that young farmers aren't interested in growing corn or soy. They want to grow food for people. They want to have a direct affiliation. So it goes, this is a two-way street. This is not just the consumers want to know where the food's coming from, but the people actually producing the food want to know more of that. So what initiatives have you been working on, whether it's at the festivals or in between the annual conferences, that look at tomorrow's workforce and finding out what their needs, their requirements are, and trying to bolster access to more farmland?
No, it's a great question. So, you know, one way we engage in this is through our grant making. I mean, a huge portion of the proceeds that we make from the concert go out to the countryside through our grants to nonprofit organizations, including New Entry Sustainable Farming Project and folks who are doing farmer training programs across the country. And that, you know, has remained a commitment for us. You know, we're different than other grant makers in that we have to work for the money. It's not coming out of some fund that we get to spend down, right? So every year we're working for it, and we're glad that a big portion of that is going out to other folks who are our partners. And then it also supports work we're doing, you know, in the confines of our office and out in the countryside. So we run a hotline, 1-800-FARMAID, and we hear from farmers every day, including beginning farmers, who want to know how they can have access to federal programs, want to know what's in their neck of the woods that can help them, or that are hitting snags. Maybe they've exited an incubator program. You know, they know how to farm agronomically, and they're out there. Maybe they've got land and they hit a snag with a program, or they've gone through a natural disaster and aren't sure what their options are. You know, we, through our hotline and through the partner organizations that we're able to refer farmers to, are there to try to help them navigate their options. So we also, you know, I think have this ability to see where farmers are entering and also what the challenges and opportunities may be for them throughout their career. I think there's a lot we're learning still about viable careers in agriculture. And I think one of the things we're learning is, you know, it's challenging to, the startup costs are challenging, the costs of land. And in a lot of ways, the concentration of markets into the hands of very few, very big corporate players very much influences the ability of farmers to find those alternative markets. So, you know, it's this constant struggle. I think there's a lot of opportunities for folks to jump in. And we have to get real about what those challenges are. And we need folks who are working with farmers, much like Jennifer does, to be in the trenches with them throughout the whole life cycle of their career on the land, so that we're really making sure we're translating their needs at state and federal levels in the design of programs that are there to serve them, and to make sure that the design of food and agricultural policy isn't continuing on this treadmill it's been on, which is really supporting the needs of very few corporate players. And it's easy to talk the game about getting new farmers on the land. I think those of us who are in the trenches working with those farmers know that there's some hollow talk right now about that. There's a lot more that could and should be done to support those who are committed to a career on the land.
Yeah, Alicia, I would agree. And Jennifer, when someone comes to FarmAid and they're sitting there scratching their head and saying, I wish there was some kind of a project that gave me new entry to sustainable farming. How do you handle that? What would you do? Take a, you know, take the baton from an interested party that comes there? And I think there's a macro trend of folks in the millennial generation that want to do something around food. They want to get their hands dirty. They're looking for career choices. They're looking to be more immersed. It's kind of primal in who we are. We've developed as a species, and maybe it's just taking the pendulum swung out so far, we're coming back. How do you capture that and work within your program?
Yeah, so I mean, I really appreciate the work that, that you guys are doing to just continue to have this narrative out there, because I feel like that's step number one, is we have to we have to encourage people to consider agriculture as a career pathway. If that is not made more visible to people, then we'll never get those calls that people are interested, but they don't know how to get started. And so that's kind of our challenge, is to continue to counter this dominant narrative that it's too challenging to get into farming, and it's there are all these hurdles like land access and capital and market development, all that, that are just too hard. So I'm not going to try. So that's not the narrative we're trying to promote. We're trying to be realistic about all of these challenges, and that it's going to be very challenging. But there are good things happening on the ground that can allow people to try it as a career vocation. You know, there's plenty of training opportunities, ways to learn and educate yourself. There are incubator farm training programs like New Entry and hundreds of others across the country that are making the space available. There are public entities that are preserving land for agricultural parks and agricultural activities. There are towns and communities across the landscape that are preserving farmland for the future of agriculture. There is market development, alternative local and regional food systems work that's happening. There is a counter narrative there, and we just need to continue to lift that up and then help producers who are not sure how to navigate these systems and how to connect to practical skills and market development and getting the capital when they're ready and making sure they can manage that and deal with all the economic viability and the social aspect of it as well. I've been on a little horn lately, tooting my own little horn, or about, you know, the social sustainability piece of agriculture is a really important part of the three-legged stool that sometimes I think the ag system in general ignores a little bit. We really care about the financial viability and the economic impacts, but we really need to care about the farmers and how they interact, how they come and arrive at their businesses, how they're doing mentally, emotionally, spiritually, interacting with their community, with their families, how they're treating their workers, the communication that needs to happen in the home. I mean, this is a kind of business that's not just something where you leave your home and go off to work. Yeah. I mean, a family farm is a family unit. And so there's so many other dynamics that need to be attended to there. And so I know you guys do a great job with the hotline as dealing with that aspect, which is a really important piece of it.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that social sustainability piece is actually a big thread of where farming came in. I think we have to bring those conversations out of the shadows, both when farmers are struggling and also how we build community around food and agriculture. I think one of the paradoxes that we're increasingly seeing, for example, in some rural areas, is the eroding of the social infrastructure for the folks who grow our food, or why is that such an isolating profession? And that starts to play into well-being. But, you know, what we're seeing in, for example, in Connecticut and in so many of the cities there, whether it's Hartford or New Haven or Bridgeport or these other places we got to visit, was how urban spaces were being transformed into spaces for growing food, and how particularly for people of color who live in those areas, because it is such a segregated, unfortunately, landscape in that state. They're finding power through food again, and they're finding community through being able to grow and nurture crops and bring those to their neighbors. And I think whether you're doing that in an urban space or a rural space, that the hope of that and the connection you feel in cultivating life and feeding people is part of what keeps them in it. And we don't talk about that enough. It's, you know, I don't know any farmer I've spoken to who doesn't bring in that element. It's a lifestyle. It's a way of being. And until we value that as a culture and see that the process of growing food is more than creating a widget, and until we start valuing it that way, I don't think we're going to get it right. I think we're going to keep putting the people who grow our food in these untenable corners. And we've got to embrace the lifestyle on the land as and make that viable, and not make it have to always answer to systems that weren't built with that ethic.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. I feel like there's been all these conversations on the Com Food listserv the past few days about meat being the villain, and I feel like, you know, when you talk to many of the farmers of the middle, you know, that's not how they wanted to be raising their livestock. It's just sort of these market forces have continued to pressure these, you know, all of these types of farming systems that we're seeing now as the scale has just, you know, people want to save their family farm and their family unit. And so the market drives and policy drives a lot of that. And
Oh, all the time. Our show last year was in Pittsburgh area, and you know, there's a lot of farmers making that choice about fracking and fracking contracts, right? When your back is against the wall and someone's saying, I can, you know, give you this opportunity, you know, I'm not going to judge someone for making those choices. I think we have to understand what, like you're saying, what is forcing people into those corners. And that's where we come back to those opportunities for bridge building and building movements and saying, hey, you know, these folks are also being put in a corner, and who's maybe benefiting from the fact that we all have our backs against the wall?
Well, it's and when you frack, you can do a little party trick and light your faucet on fire, too, right? So another extra side there. You know, I think that is an externality. And what we're finding within all food production is there's a lot of externalities that are not put onto the bottom line. You spoke about a community of love, and I think that probably is an incredible support system needed for all farmers, whether they're huge in spectrum or very small. But there's still the reality of economics here. And economics become the things that wake you up at 4 o'clock in the morning and scratch your head. And then it's great to have a support system. But if you can't make the payments, if you can't make your payroll for the week or the month, that becomes extremely challenging. And then there are realities of farming where there's a lot of inconsistencies. So, you know, one thing that we put in there is subsidies at a federal level. And I think a lot of from a fly in the wall type approach, or other countries looking at us, scratch their heads and think, well, how do you have a subsidy approach like this? Where it's really around, and a gentleman named Volker Dinglesman, who presented to the UN, talked about when you anonymize food, we commoditize it, you anonymize it, right? And so you lose all those associated values to it, and you're just creating a widget or a good that gets put in it, and it loses the community, loses the support system. And it builds this really economic model, which is the only driving factor of that. And I just want to add a couple two points to that, because we have a 2018 farm bill that's on the bill, on the docket, for then trying to get streamlined through before maybe a change of guard in November. And also, just recently with the social or the geopolitical conversations that have happened around tariffs and the subsidies associated to that. So the USDA will start doling out $4.7 billion of the $12 billion that have been promised around tariffs, and mostly for commodity goods that have been impacted by our geopolitical stance that we've taken. There's also another plan to buy about $1.2 billion of food backed by the USDA, earmarked for kids and lower income Americans. We'll see how that gets appropriately used. But that's the plan. It's been stated that, for instance, in dairy, we've been talking about New England dairy here, that $127 million of that will be set aside for dairy, which is estimated to cover only 10% of the losses that the dairymen and dairywomen will receive for this newly minted international tariffs that have been placed on their products, mostly going to China. The National Corn Growers Association said that they've understood that from the beginning that this aid package would neither make their farmers whole nor offset the long-term erosion of export markets. But it's even lower than their expectations, and they were disappointed that does not consider the extent the damage that's having on corn farmers, which are probably one of the more subsidized programs in this country. And then over the past decade, we've been held victim to these commodity bubbles. Again, this anonymous approach to food and how we get stuck with commodity bubbles associated to what's supposed to be our sustenance, what's supposed to keep a stable planet, which is supposed to keep clean water and not being able to light that on fire, coming from these approaches of why we're raising their food. So, Alicia, if you could comment maybe about what's the current state of the farm economy? Are we really in a crisis? Do we really have to reshuffle the way that we're doling out these subsidies? And how much of that can be changed by us, the consumers?
Well, you know, we spent time this summer surveying a set of hotlines and farm crisis counselors we know throughout the countryside. There's not very many of them. There needs to be more of them to answer that question of, are we in a farm crisis? And I think we are. I think, you know, we know that farm income nationally, and these are averages, right? So they really can obfuscate the severity and extremes within it. But we're in a multi-year slump, and farm income is more than 50% below, or is a 50% cut from where it was in 2013, right? And we've been increasingly over the last 5 years feeling that intensifying pressure over our hotline, as have the other folks we work with. They're all saying, yeah, there's more people calling us. The nature of the predicament they're in is more severe and more dire. You know, people have been dipping in and cutting away at their equity, you know, and that's becoming untenable now. You know, it's untenable in dairy, where farmers are bleeding red ink anytime they're milking their cows. So, yeah, we are in a crisis. And I think what's important to elevate, you know, above all the noise of tariff battles and, you know, pointing the finger at this or that, is we abdicated an approach of ensuring a fair price to farmers a long time ago in farm policy. The 80s were an important wave of that process. And that shift in farm policy, it was a conscious choice to shift away from stabilizing farm prices, and, for what it's worth, prices for eaters as well. I mean, that there was a dual approach that actually was cheaper. It was a cheaper way of allocating taxpayer resources to decide to set price floors or supply management programs so that we don't have this boom and bust cycle that impacts farmers and eaters alike. We really, you know, slowly dismantled those programs, and then really quickly, what's the word I'm looking for, accelerated sort of the free trade neoliberal approach that open markets and export markets were going to be able to compensate for that removal of fair pricing for farmers. As we suspected, it's not turned out to be true. It's not turned out to be a system that's going to create new farmers coming in. You know, it's driven more and more profits to fewer and fewer players. And so, you know, we've always been skeptical that of the narrative that export markets and, you know, pushing farmers to get bigger and produce more to make up for what our prices below their cost of production or just at the margin is a sustainable approach to food production, or one that answers these other, you know, the social measures of sustainability, you know, the environmental, right? Like those externalities we're talking about. To us, the core, one of the core roots of that is that failure to say the people who grow our food deserve to make a living doing that, just like anyone else who touches our food, just like any farm worker or food worker. And again, just like any worker in our economies, right? We've got to change the lens and take the anonymity out of food. I think that's right. I'm really glad. I like that language. I'm going to start using it.
Oh, hey. Well, I'm going to take a lot of your language you just used, because you just got on quite a roll right there, and that was some awesome soundbite stuff. So you'll hear that plenty. Nice job. Jennifer, well, Alicia, I'll say one of the trends or the process we use here in Sourcing Matters is we get to these really high and broad questions, and we turn it over to Jennifer to answer those questions. So Jennifer, she is a smarty, and I do take a ton of notes every time she says things. And again, sound bites come very verbose from you. So what else do we need to know about this? What are some of these solutions to these major issues, whether it's economic or family or community discussions? So maybe you could share some final thoughts here in our conversation.
Well, I wanted to point out to all of our listeners that October 12th is National Farmers Day. I just learned about this through a listserv that I'm on. I thought that would be a great way to kind of close out and talk about raising more awareness of the role of family farmers in our food system. It's happening. I'm curious to see what coverage, if any, in the press this gets. But a good point in time to note and reflect. But I guess I always feel challenged to like solve all these system-wide problems in the very last last few minutes here. So maybe Alicia, sounds like you have something to say. I'm going to pass the buck.
Well, it's, I would say that it's not the only answer, but this year on the stage, in between his sets, Neil Young turned to the audience and said, you know, for all you drivers out there, you're going to drive your family home from this event. Do not pass a farmer's market without stopping in, without introducing your kids to the people who grow food. Buy something good, buy something real. Look at the plants, look at the, you know, what's around you. And then he would do a set, and then he'd come back and say, what are you going to do when you pass the farmer's market? And the whole crowd would scream, stop. And I have to tell you, our social media was started to get flooded in the days after the show with people sharing pictures of stopping at these farm stands across New England on their way back home. And I say that, you know, we shouldn't be putting the failures of systems on individuals, right? You know, we shouldn't, this is true for climate change too. Yeah, there are things we can do, but there's 100 companies that are responsible for vast majority of carbon emissions, and we need to be holding them accountable. And that is true. And I think that connection that we can keep building with the people who are doing good work, with the, you know, finding ways to connect back to the people, that strengthens us and I think clarifies for us what it is we're fighting for and how we can keep connecting it. And it's the first step in really a cultural shift. And so I want to lift that up because I think we were so heartened to see all these people who took what Neil said and ran with it. And I don't know what their paths will lead, you know, what CSAs they might start joining, what conversations they might start getting engaged in, organizations where they might become members. But I think that we shouldn't underestimate the power of that while we work on holding accountable those that are driving these systems, creating new ones. You know, that happens through those moments, I think. So that's my thought.
Wow, that's a great way to leave it, I think.
It is. And so as Neil Young recommends to stop at the local mm-hmm. farmer's market, and John Mellencamp tells him to go back to the little pink houses and cook it as a family, right? There is some great advice that comes out from this amplification. And obviously they're vested in this, and they do have a certain level of clout in the fact that you're welcoming their social outreach, their social graph, and connecting to that and giving people some kind of a empowerment or touch point to get involved, even small steps. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's just a thread to grab and take it. That's a big win. So Alicia, maybe you could share with our audience where they could learn more about Farm Aid. Where is the 2019 event going to take place? Now that you're
top secret,
now you're 11 months out and that you're thinking about 24,000 people coming to you again. But you know, where can we learn more about this and how can we stay active?
Yeah. So www.farmaid.org is our website, and there's a whole slew of ways to engage, whether it's taking action on policy opportunities right now, reading about farmer heroes and people that are doing inspiring things in your neck of the woods, learning about the organizations in your neck of the woods that we fund and why we fund them and how you can support them and become members of their work. There's a whole number of things through that portal of engagement. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all the socials. So please dig in with us. Get engaged.
Great. I will put links on social media, of your social media graph on the write-up of this. So I'll just say that, you know, what I was intrigued to learn about today is I was somewhat familiar with what Farm Aid was doing with the big festivals, but to hear the preliminary events, the breakout mm-hmm. sessions, to talk about hands-on experiences and letting folks really materialize what food can represent or should represent to them as a silver bullet of change for their communities, for their own health, for the environmental health, is intriguing. It's exciting that an organization of your stature is taking a lead foot forward with that. So thank you so much for taking the time to have a conversation with Jennifer and myself today. We really appreciate it. And I'll just say until next time.
Yeah, please. Let's do it again. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks so much.
Thank you.